Nah, I don't like that.
Well, try just putting a, even if it takes a hair more time, putting a little bit more of a wry thing on correct.
Correct 13.
Bad News, Angry Voices from Around the World, is a monthly news program in English, based on short segments by all radios of the Anarchist Radio Network. It's put together every month by a different project in a rotating mode, so every project should only be doing this every 1 to 5. Oh, this is really boring. If this news is bad, I don't want to be good.
Greetings, comrade, to this, the 46th, mostly monthly episode of Bad News, Angry Voices from Around the World. As a correction to my former comment, the A-Radio Network is not singularly anarchists. It includes autonomous and anti-authoritarian anti-capitalist projects and individuals. You can find our past shows, info about the network, participating projects, and how your project can get involved at our website, a-radio-network.org. This month you'll hear updates from Free Social Radio 1431 AM in Thessaloniki, Greece, speaking on the trial of anarchist Vagelis Stathopoulos, the recent labor bill, and new obligatory shared custody laws in Greece. After that, you'll hear an interview by A-Radio Berlin with comrades from Horn Anarchists on the situation in Ethiopia and the war on the people of Tigray. That's followed by Radio Zones of Subversive Expression in Athens, sharing news on demonstrations against sexual harassments on public transit, changes in policy of public servants witnessing in courts against members of the population, and struggles against the greenwashing of dispossession and infrastructure projects in Agrafa and other parts of Greece. Finally, the lovelies at Frequenza share a longer interview with perspectives of a student in Colombia about the current fracas against police, austerity, COVID, and for radical change.
Greetings from Thessaloniki, Greece.
From Free Social Radio.
1431 AM.
On 23rd of April, anarchist Vagelis Stathopoulos was sentenced in 19 years in prison solely because he tried to help an injured comrade, Hadzivasiliadis, after the latter was self-injured during a theft attempt. There is no solid evidence that Stathopoulos participated in the theft, but even in that case, he could only be sentenced for misdemeanor. But after phony evidence and anonymous calls at counter-terrorist service, he was charged as a member of a terrorist group called Revolutionary Struggle. Basically, Stathopoulos is in prison for his anarchist identity, which he clearly defended in front of the judges, and for his attempts to get injured Hadzivasiliadis access to a doctor. Since then, many actions of solidarity have taken place throughout Greece, until every cage is burned, until everyone is free.
On May 12, a new law was passed by the Greek government about child custody. The law states that child custody automatically and compulsorily goes to both parents equally in case of divorce or even when both parents recognize legally a child born outside of marriage. Up until now, usually the custody was given to the mother with some rights of visitation from the father. And in the cases that the custody was given to both parents, it was because they both peacefully and collectively agreed so, not because a judge decided so. This new law and its authoritarian power over a child's life does not include parameters of the child's benefit or opinion, and even more for cases of domestic abuse, as it recognizes that the parent loses the right for said child custody only after if they are found irrevocably guilty of physical violence, which is rare in cases of domestic violence. Under this law, all decision for the child must be taken from both parents, and if they don't agree on something, then it's up to the court to decide. A parent can appeal on this decision, but it can take years of court hearings, and meanwhile, the child is shared like an object with its abuser.
Anti-labor bill. The Hadzidakis bill is the continuation of a long series of laws of the Greek state where under the pretext of increasing the competitiveness of companies that will thus contribute to the economy, started the overall deregulation of the labor market with the main characteristics of changing the schedule from fixed to flexible working hours, reducing labor costs and labor rights. The modern working day that has been shaped thanks to the previous legislations that have been implemented is full of insecurity and pressure due to the fear of dismissal, low wages, split working hours, increased rates of work. Many bosses in Greece don't pay the workers their gifts, put employees who are suspended to work, insure the employees for 4 hours, make them work 8 and 10 hours, sexually harass, commit violence, bully, etc., etc. All this with the support of the state that continuously allowed such practice to be perpetuated and even proceeds to consolidate and worsen them. Probably submitted on June 17th, the aforementioned bill, in which you provide elimination of the 8 work period and imposition of 50 working hours per week with the imposition of individual employment contracts. Bosses will be able to employ employees to a maximum of 10 hours per day without additional pay, provided that within the same 6 months they pay their hours with a corresponding reduction in hours or breaks or day offs. Increasing the hours of legal overtime to 150 hours with the increase of the limits, the legal overtime work will become cheaper. The possibility of a legal claim for re-employment is abolished even in the case where the dismissal is deemed abusive, with a payment of compensation, thus giving the bosses full immunity for the dismissals.
Abolition of the body of labor inspectors and its transformation into independent authority, in fact it will be fully controlled by the state. Criminalization of the strike guard that will lead to the termination of the strike with a court decision under the pretext of the possible physical or psychological violence that can be exercised by the strike. At least 33.3% of the services are required in addition to the security staff, which means that a large part of the workers will have to work during a strike. Remote voting, in particular for strike decision. The measure undermines both the exchange of views and the general assemblies themselves. Mandatory file of all members of a union and its activities so that employees can exercise their union rights in the already legislated register of trade unions maintained in the information system ERGANI of the Ministry of Labour. Flexibility in remote working in the form of either full-time or part-time employment.
In the following interview, A Radio Berlin had the opportunity of talking to comrades from the Horn of Africa about the ongoing war in that region since the end of 2020. You'll hear about the historical background, the role of Nobel Prize winner the Ethiopian Prime Minister Abiy, and more. For different reasons, this interview has been in the making for a long time and was originally a written interview, which is why we used our own voices to make it audible.
To start out, could you tell us a bit about your collective?
We are a small collective that got together early 2020. We are currently working to introduce and spread anarchism and anarchist ideas to Amharic and Tigrinya speakers, mainly through online collaborative platforms. Some of us are located in the Horn, though others are members of the diaspora, and we try to engage in some pragmatic projects in terms of intersectional activism and mutual aid in our respective locations.
We want to talk to you about the ongoing war in the Tigray region in the north of Ethiopia. Could you give us an overview of how things are at the moment?
It has now been over 6 months since the breakout of the war in Tigray. The people of Tigray have been in a complete telecommunication blackout ever since the war started, up until the partial reinstallation of telecom services in certain parts of Tigray just a few weeks back. There have been reports by aid organizations that more than 4.6 million people are in dire conditions as the supply of life, sustaining humanitarian assistance, electricity, and the water supply have all been disconnected. And 2.2 million people are estimated to have been internally displaced. There were 7,000 refugees a day fleeing to Sudan on the earlier days of the war, but even this number has significantly dropped after Ethiopian and Eritrean soldiers blocked the border with Sudan to prevent Tigrayans from fleeing. The fascistic, genocidal regime in Addis had officially announced the completion of the war. They call it quote-unquote law enforcement operation. But the population continues to be targeted by revanchist militias from the neighboring region and the brutal Eritrean mercenaries that are going on a gang rape spree, burning crops and farmlands, stealing livestock, terrorizing and punishing the people. What is happening in Tigray is a genocide that has been brewing for years and involves international actors, notably the United Arab Emirates, whose drones have been used to shell Tigray cities, and Eritrea, whose mercenaries have taken over some parts of Tigray in what appears to be an attempt to exterminate Tigrayans and the Tigrayan identity. The broader international community cannot be exempted from taking responsibility anymore because word is getting out. People are risking their lives to expose what the genocidal regime is doing, so the world would act to stop the genocide. But the best we have heard so far was that the international community was, quote, gravely concerned about the ethnic cleansing, but no measures to protect civilians from these two brutal regimes of Afewerki of Eritrea and Abiy of Ethiopia.
Could you give us a bit of historical background to understand the tensions between Ethiopia and the Tigray region?
An article by Gebrekristos Gebremeskel, The War on Tigray, A Multi-Pronged Assault Driven by Genocidal Undercurrents, covers a decades-long anti-Tigrayan empire-building process that was determined to impoverish Tigray to make it submissive. This anti-Tigrayan empire-building became even more evident the last 3 years when the hatred was state-sponsored and no longer mistaken for regime hatred. Note that the coalition that ruled Ethiopia for 27 years prior to the reform was dominated by Tigrayan People's Liberation Front, or TPLF, and anti-Tigrayan speech was often misunderstood to be an anti-government speech and so passed unchallenged. However, once Abiy Ahmed came to power, he seized the media to disseminate fascistic propaganda and blame the human rights abuses that have been taking place in the previous administration on Tigrayan speakers. This resulted in the development of an overt and observable violence against Tigrayans living in other parts of the country. The TPLF, the dominant party in the four-party coalition that ruled Ethiopia for almost 2 decades, was a political force that started as an insurgent group rebelling against the dictatorial military junta, but later aided and abetted the expansion of an empire that would come back to eat it.
What is the role of European colonialism in creating these conflicts in the first place? And what role does it still play nowadays?
European colonialism had a lasting effect in Africa, especially regarding the formation of borders and modern nation-states. Almost all African states are results of the colonial project. However, we do not think this war is a European colonialism legacy, as it is a fascist trying to bomb and starve a population of 6 million for the sake of, quote, prosperity and peace. However, European governments are responsible for enabling this genocidal war on Tigray by propping up Abiy, earning him legitimacy and covering for his crimes for the sake of the neoliberal reforms he promised to bring.
What do you think could be the results of this war?
What we feared most was that there would be a brutal ethnic cleansing in the dark. But that has already happened in Western Tigray and continues to happen even though the international community knows that it is happening and there are many evidences of genocide coming out in different formats. The collective punishment tactic PM Abiy is using is starving many, and we're hearing many do not have access to life-saving medicine. We believe that the TPLF will engage an insurgency for years or even decades to come. And even if the top tiers of the TPLF are captured, it is hard to imagine that the people of Tigray will welcome a regional president and, quote, CEO imposed by a fascistic leader with open arms. The popular support this war has in other parts of the country also indicates the fascism that's taking over the rest of Ethiopia and is making it inconceivable for many to think that Tigray will continue as part of Ethiopia. So we expect a very strong and long independence movement to kindle following this. In an attempt to subdue dissent, the Ethiopian National Defense Force is now engaged in forced conscriptions of young Tigrayans in the areas under their control and widespread rape of young women and girls. This has led to able-bodied young men and women going into the bushes to joining the TDF, the Tigrayan Defense Forces, which is now sort of like the Tigrayan People's Army that is joined by students, laborers, teachers, doctors, and generally anyone who doesn't want to be bombed in their homes or massacred in churches without sufficient training, because there isn't much other options if you want to defend yourself, your community, and your identity.
Prime Minister Abiy had been awarded the Nobel Peace Prize in 2019. How has this influenced his positions or acting in this war?
As Arwa Makhtawi once said, the Nobel Peace Prize is like a who's who of hawks and war criminals. The most recent recipients of this award, including the genocidal war criminal Abiy Ahmed, Juan Manuel Santos, the EU, and Barack Obama, make the case for themselves, so we don't want to be pretentious and say we expected better from the Nobel Peace Prize Committee, because honestly, we don't. But what's very interesting here is the person that recommended Abiy for the Peace Prize and wrote a very compelling letter of his accomplishments, Mr. Awol Alo, is now at the forefront of those taking a critical stance against Abiy, with many even asking for the Peace Prize to be revoked. We can't also deny the legitimacy and popularity of the Nobel Peace Prize or the enthralling Peace Prize speech about the horrors of growing up in a war that got him the award in the first place. The international fame and support he received for his charm made it impossible for many to assume that he would really be capable of committing all the horrors refugees were telling.
Are there any anti-militaristic or even anti-nationalist sentiments in parts of the population?
Unfortunately, that's not the case. The EPRDF was a very tyrannical regime and people loathe it. And after his accession to power in 2018, Abiy has been using impressive PR tactics in demonizing the TPLF. Extensive human rights violations committed under the EPRDF's rule have been attributed to the TPLF in specific and the Tigrinya speakers populace in general. There were multiple massacres occurring in different parts of the country, most of which were blamed on the TPLF and the OLF without any evidence or even a questionable legal process. The decade-long militant nationalism developing in parts of the country now seems to be at its peak, costing thousands of lives. The concern now mostly is retaliation and revenge, not multinational cooperation against fascism and oppression. Some people believe this is a war for justice and lasting peace. They believe it will be the end of all the horrors we have been hearing in the past 3 years, the killings that Abiy has attributed to TPLF without any evidence, but it will not. Others have held a grudge against TPLF and the people of Tigray for long, and this is a chance for vengeance. And for Ethiopianist fanatics, this is a chance to dismantle the ethnic federalism the country has been under the last 3 decades and bring about a more centralized state. The divergent interests, the strong state control of media and narrative, and the repression of anti-war voices has led the public to be misguided into supporting a war of which it will be a victim in the long haul. More recently, the reports from state media are those that indicate the war is now over in Tigray, but there are also reports coming out of independent media that the war has been very brutal and that it continues targeting civilians and uses rape and hunger as weapons.
What can anarchists do in such a situation?
Anarchists globally are showing solidarity with Tigray by taking part in organizing protests, raising awareness, boycotting companies that are aiding and enabling the genocide and supporting in the most creative ways. We have comrades from all over the world DMing us on Twitter, @HornAnarchists, and offering their support in organizing protests in their cities, helping out with graphics, sending us pictures of actions for Tigray that they have took part in, and we are beyond grateful to that. We also continue to urge local anarchists to engage in anti-war activism and help organize support for those victimized by the war.
As we have seen all over the world in times of crisis, of war or natural catastrophes like earthquakes, time and again anarchists and anti-authoritarians have had an amazing ability of organizing self-help on the spot, much earlier and sometimes more resilient than states could. Have you experienced some of that?
We don't know if that has happened in all parts of Tigray because of the blackout. However, the people are faced with revanches that want to exterminate them and left with barely any resources, with banks closed and supply chains demolished. We think community self-organizing and mutual aid is the only way people can survive this. New reports from Mekele, the capital of Tigray, also indicate that the people were able to save lives through mutual aid. But we are sure there will be many fascinating coping ways people used once the state was dysfunctional and the only way of survival was cooperation.
How is COVID-19 affecting the situation in Ethiopia? And how is everyday life for common people?
Luckily, Ethiopia isn't among those hard hit by COVID. A few months ago, many people working in the service industry had lost their jobs, but things seemed to be getting back to business as usual now that the restrictions were lifted. Nonetheless, there are reports of many tests coming out positive, and this is a huge concern as to what is happening in Tigray with all transportation blocked and the federal government suspending the budget and refusing to send COVID test kits, masks, and sanitizers that were meant to be for the people of Tigray.
Where can people find more information in English about the war, maybe even from an anti-authoritarian perspective?
Since Abiy Ahmed has blocked media access, most news of what was happening were coming from refugees that have managed to flee. International media were talking to refugees and coming out with stories. But now that limited media have access to certain parts of the region, and Twitter users like @Meaza and @MapEthiopia provide updates from various sources. Following the hashtags Tigray Genocide and Stop War on Tigray, also give a picture of recent developments, and @OmnaTigray organizes campaigns and gives analysis of what's happening.
This is Bad News, episode 46 of June 2021 by the Radio Zones of Subversive Expression.
On June 6th, the Open Assembly Against Green Growth and Wind in Agrafa called together with other collectives in Tibanos of Argithea, where work has begun on the installation of wind turbines and the construction of the substation, taking advantage of the pandemic and destruction of the area from the Mediterranean cyclone Ianos. Despite the attack by the repression units, the protesters resisted and regrouped, continuing the mobilization, shouting the slogans, making it clear that they will not back down until the work is stopped. In its call, the Open Assembly calls on the inhabitants of the Agrafian villages and the cities of the plain to be vigilant for a cessation and blocking of the works, for a relentless struggle for land and freedom.
On the occasion of the ever-increasing complaints about incidents of sexual harassment in the neighborhoods of southern suburbs, a mobilization was organized on Friday the 4th of June 2021 at 9 p.m. with a call in the metro of Argyropoli. The mobilization is inspired by the reclaim of the night movement that emerged in the 70s in Britain from feminist groups to reoccupy the city for women and the night. The center's slogan was "On the street, on the metro, at night, to be free, not brave." The gathering in the metro of Argyropoli, in a very positive atmosphere, remained in the area for about an hour to highlight the collective presence and protection of women against the incidents that took place in the metro of Argyropoli in previous weeks. Then, a block of up to 150 people was formed that crossed Gerulanou, the alleys of Sourmenos, Yasonidou, within the next 2 hours and finally returned to Gerulanou, passed through the shops and ended up in Varnali Square. The march had a strong pulse with slogans against gender-based violence, patriarchy, heteronormativity, police violence and sexual harassment in restaurants. Many people reacted positively, went out on the balconies, applauded and even went on their way. The initiative was organized by the newly formed Witches of the South team. This mobilization, the first of its kind in our region, leaves behind an optimistic message and promise of struggle.
Since 1st of June, according to an instruction of the Ministry of Immigration and Asylum, public servants are prohibited from attending as witnesses in trials where the public is accused of illegal acts, as it is said to safeguard the interests of the Greek state. The directive informs the civil servants that any testimony in favor of the opponents and against the Greek state constitutes a disciplinary misconduct and a criminal offense. As mentioned below, the affidavit of ministry officials is allowed only to support the allegations of the Greek state, and all this in a ministry against which a series of serious cases are pending even at European level. The state is getting shielded in every way.
Okay, we are glad to have the opportunity to talk to Vanessa, Colombian citizen based in Leipzig at the moment, and she will tell us about the current situation, the current uprisings in Colombia. Hello, Vanessa. Thanks for taking the time to talk with us.
Hello. Thank you very much for having me, for inviting me.
So maybe we can talk first really briefly about the things which caused the current uprising in Colombia to listeners which maybe not have heard about it so far.
Okay, so right now in Colombia, for people who maybe are not informed of it, we've been through a month already of continuous protests. Causes of it, plenty. And actually, we have to say this didn't just started 1 month ago. This was something that was just about to happen for so many years. And it actually did start in the 2019, the 21st of November of 2019. And then at the beginning of 2012, it got stopped because of COVID situation, the pandemic situation. It was really a convenient thing for the government, because then it was easy just to say, okay, we're all in lockdown, it's a pandemic, everyone has to stay home. And then this protests movement had to reclude in this pandemic context. And then we had this year of pandemics, really bad, it was a really bad managed situation in Colombia, Latin America as a whole, but Colombia especially, because the whole political scene and atmosphere wasn't that good. People started seeing how government during this year had more and more laws and making a lot of decisions that weren't good for public as a whole, that weren't good for middle and lower classes in Colombia. These were the sectors of the population, the gross sector of this population, getting all the burdens and no benefits out of all the things that were being approved. And actually, what made this explode all over again a month ago was a proposed of a bill tax in which medium and lower classes were taking the greatest part of this burden, economic burden. In fact, to make up for the money that the government has been kind of stealing and not using very well. And you know why we're missing this money. Why are we in such a high debt? But then being the lower class and medium class getting to put this money, of course, no one has how to afford it. This year we reached 42% of poverty because of all these regulations and late laws from the government. So it was just like this really punch for the middle and lower classes in Colombia. Everyone went back to the streets. No one caring more about COVID. This was way more powerful. It was way more dangerous for people to have in this law approved than getting COVID. You know, like getting COVID seemed a really soft and not a very light thing in comparison to all the other things that were happening.
Yeah, but maybe we should also mention that you cannot compare like middle class, for example, in Germany with the middle class in Colombia, right?
Yeah, no. Middle class in Colombia, it's really impoverished medium class. So medium class would be this people that are really struggling to get through, in which all the family has to work and pay, you know, for getting the household to run. It's also middle classes in which young population doesn't have that much opportunities. So the young people are getting really high debts and getting into credits just for their studies, for example. And then they're lucky if they can get a job after they graduate at university, if they ever do. So it's a totally different panorama on what a medium class is if we go back to Colombia.
Okay, back to the protest. How does it look like in Colombia if people protest in the streets, and how did it look like the last month?
Well, that's the thing I really like to talk about, to share with people, because protests in Colombia are like a huge, amazing party in the streets. So protests in Colombia are moved by young population and by the artistic sector mainly. So it's this really artistic expression of it through music, through theater, through the graphic expression, the paintings that we're seeing right now in the street, that are also this cry of, where are all the missing people? What's going on? We're going to be here until you listen. And this has all been shown in a very graphic, artistic way. Music from all sectors of the country, because they are so varied, so different, so diverse. They're all coming together. So African music, Caribbean music, all these expressions coming together. And also, that's an important thing to mention now. It's been to a huge unity of all the population in Colombia that have been neglected for so long. Indigenous populations are moving to the cities to accompany the protests, such as the Nasa people in Cauca. They were in Cali for a while, and in Bogota as well. The Misak community was protesting there and being very active, Afro-Colombian communities, and of course the young population in lower and middle classes. And also I think the theater scene, it's very active in showing and bringing in an artistic way conflicts of the country and putting them into a scene and showing it. I think this is what makes it that vivid and that powerful. It's about arts and music and expressing through that tools. Also, a thing that have been going on really, really hard right now, it's the collective action. So cooking together in the streets for the people who are protesting. Mainly women and old people are doing this. So they're going to the streets and they're just cooking for the people that are being there the whole day. Medicine students are being there just to help people if they need support, if they get injured. So it's been really huge because everyone is put in something.
I also read that there's an organization called URC, like trying to organize these kind of actions, like soup kitchens and stuff, and organize in the neighborhood in form of general assemblies or something. Can you tell a little bit about that?
Yeah, I mean,
that?
Germany is...
Yes, for example, in Cali, as a result of this popular associations, let's call it, a lot of them are, in fact, to support indigenous community. Because in Cali we have so close Cauca region, which is an indigenous department, mainly, of course, not entirely, but there's a strong indigenous community there. So they are in solidarity with these communities, but also in solidarity with the protesters themselves. For example, there's a really nice one called La Olla de la Dignidad. I don't know how to translate that. It would be like the dignity pot, something like this. So they are the ones cooking. And they are cooking not just for protesters, but they are having these free collective meals in right now really poor sectors, which are struggling just to get the food. And also, it's been hard for them to keep up in this scenario of being in the streets all the time for a month. A lot of people have stopped just working, a lot of enterprises had to close. So this kind of solidarity assemblies and associations, they are channeling resources that they are gathering through donations, through international donations as well, through cooperations, they're channeling these resources so that they can target these people in the neighborhoods and in the smaller pieces of the city, like in the smaller areas.
We have seen also like really harsh violence from the police against protesters, and even paramilitary groups, armed groups are in the streets. I don't know, maybe working together with the police or working on their own like plan. And how can people face this kind of repression there in Colombia?
Well, that's the really the ugly side of it, and that's actually why it has getting all this international attention, because to this really happy, powerful artistic expression and very legitimate expression of protest, the response has been violent and repression. All cities are being militarized, so we're having military 24/7 in the main cities: Bogota, Medellin, Cali. And of course, with the repressions are not just the repressions, but the outcomes of it. We're having hundreds of people that are missing. And in Colombia, we already know what happens with people that goes missing by the public forces, by police and military groups. So that's why we're the cry right now. It's where are they? Because we already know what is the risk of having so many people missing.
There's a lot of tortures, violations and stuff going on. It's also used kind of tool to repress people like this.
Yeah,
kind of.
And in the past it's also been a way to present them later as criminals, as members of irregular, illegal armed groups and this kind of things, which they aren't. They were just young people who didn't have opportunities protesting in their city. So this is one thing. The other thing is the tortures going, the killings. We have a lot of people that have been murdered in this context by the police, by the military forces, and having the government doing nothing about it because they are the ones orchestrating this. It's really frustrating because in the public side of the government, every now and then when you get to see an interview of the president or the vice president or the ministers, they're all saying like, no, what's happening? That's not true. This counts, this numbers that the organizations have, they are not the ones. They are not official. So it's kind of like this kind of being in negation, like denying
showing
it publicly.
And bringing
and that's why social media has been so important.
The country,
the people itself, like recording, having Instagram lives to show what's going on, the kind of violence they're living in the street, a violence that they're living in the streets. And also this public expression of the people, it's what have also stopped some of these things. There has been this case in Cali of a guy, a musician. He was in the protest with his instrument playing music, and then he was illegally captured by the police. He was tortured, and they made him declare against himself. And they record him, and they had this video going all the place, like going viral in social media. And then everyone, when people saw it, and they say, "What the fuck? That's my friend. I was with him playing in the protest. He went missing. How come they're doing this?" Everyone got this case out to light, and he was released. And now that he's released, he's actually getting to tell what happened, how they tortured him, how he got like really brutally punched
so
by the police
are not
and forced
hoping in
to
them
declare
because
he was
of what
a
they
criminal
are...
and that he was vandalizing something and that was who. So this kind of violence, it's becoming the night terror, because during the day this is not happening. So the night, the, you know, like when everything goes dark and they can cut electricity, cut internet, leave people a bit like blocked and censored, then they can go in, get people out, get them missing, get them tortured. And this is pretty much the night scenario. During the day, we have really good and pacific protests, let's say. And in the night, then everything, it's coming out. And the thing that it's more alarming is what you mentioned, this paramilitary thing going on. So mainly we're talking about civilians, so citizens that are armed and that are backing up the violent action of police and military forces against protesters. The reason why this is so incredibly dangerous is because as a nation, we have a history of paramilitarism, of massacres done by military groups. And having it now in the cities and looking so normal to so many people, that's the thing. That's the huge danger of it. Government has said nothing about this. The government has said nothing about the civilian people armed and shooting against the protesters. One of these guys have been interviewed in national mediums, radio media, and he himself, he did a video saying, yes, we have a group to protect our neighborhood. So he's like publicly declaring they have confirmed a paramilitary group and nothing happens and everything goes normal. So this is the risk of it, like how normalized this kind of violence is.
Right. That was part of an interview we did. You can find the whole interview as other audio files about the situation in Colombia on our blog, frequenza.noblogs.org, frequenza.noblogs.org.
We sincerely hope that you enjoyed this episode of Bad News for mid-June of 2021. Stay tuned for the next installment around the middle of next and every month. Ciao!